On this week's 51%, we hear about a book that highlights women in aviation.
I think this story is for anyone who's ever been told, you're not good enough, you don't belong here, you can't do this.
Tune into a woman's story about another woman's solitary life and find out about testosterone's effect on women's hearts. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. O'Brien's latest book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History, recounts how a cadre of women banded together to shatter an outdoor glass ceiling and battle injustices that conspired to keep them out of the sky. In 1928, less than a dozen American women had a government-issued pilot's license, making the few women who flew planes true radicals. Fly Girls tells their story, the story of women fighting for the right to fly planes, winning the right to race them, and then beating the men in one of the most dangerous air races of them all. Award-winning journalist Keith O'Brien is a former Boston Globe reporter, and he's a regular contributor to NPR and has written for the New York Times Magazine. 51%'s Joe Donahue spoke with O'Brien about Fly Girls.
So what brought you to these five women and ultimately this story?
Well, I'm always looking for great story ideas. As a journalist, I'm always writing down little ideas and socking them away. And, you know, that's how I came upon this story. I was on an airplane from Boston to Pittsburgh in the spring of 2016. And for the flight, I had grabbed a book that had been sitting on my bedside table for some time. It was Lily Koppel's The Astronaut Wives Club. It was the story of the first seven astronauts, but told from the perspective of the wives. Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff is one of my favorite books of all time, and so I wanted to see how Lily had told this story from the opposite perspective. I was just a few pages into the book, and there was a paragraph about daring women and the history of daring women, and there's this reference to an all-female airplane race in 1929, a race that had featured Amelia Earhart. You know, I consider myself to be fairly well-educated, fairly well-read. I'd never heard of it. And I was on an airplane, of all places, and this airplane had Wi-Fi. And I was able to open my laptop and just start noodling around on it. And that's what it was at first, Joe. It was just me noodling around on it. But the more I read, the more I dug down, the more I knew there was something here. And by the time I landed in Pittsburgh, honestly, I knew there was something, and I knew I needed to get to a library, and that's where it all started.
So at this point of these air races, I mean, you write about this, they would draw 100,000 people, if not more, and they were paying to see this. What was it about these races that made them so popular at the time?
We forget now because, you know, the modern airlines have turned travel into at best a mode of transportation from point A to point B, and at worst a hassle. But in the late 1920s, there was real magic in flying, real romance in it, and the air races were a place where that magic really came to life. You know, as you said, you could have 100,000 paying fans in a single day, and another 100,000 who were sitting on the hoods of their parked automobiles on nearby highways watching these planes race. People wanted to see airplanes. Most people at that point had never flown in one, and to fly in one was to be almost a kind of gladiator. Because it was so romantic and so daring and so primitive, really, in its development, most men considered it the field for men. But there was a small squadron of women who refused to abide by that notion. And they wanted to not only fly airplanes, they wanted to race them too. And once they got into the air races, the female pilots were just as popular as the men, if not more so.
Your story begins in 1927. Why is that year pivotal?
Well, that's the year that Charles Lindbergh flies solo across the Atlantic. And, you know, in our mind now, we think of Lindbergh just doing this for the pioneering spirit of it. And certainly there was that. But what we forget is a wealthy New York hotel owner had put up $25,000. It's a lot of money in 1927. $25,000 for the first man, and it was presumed to be a man, to fly nonstop from New York to Paris or Paris to New York. A lot of men died trying to win that money. And finally, in the spring of 1927, Lindbergh succeeds. And when he succeeds, he instantly becomes not only rich, but he becomes one of the most famous men in the entire world and begins to travel across America in a goodwill tour that would visit some 90 cities, spreading, you know, essentially air fever. And inevitably, women were infected by the air fever as well. And by the late summer of 1927, just a few months removed from Lindbergh's success, a couple of women decide they will become the first woman to fly across the ocean. And it's interesting to note that neither of these women was named Amelia Earhart. Months before Amelia Earhart would fly the ocean in 1928, a couple of other women would try.
The women are very diverse. Talk a little bit about their backgrounds and how they come to this, because it's not like it's a set pattern.
Sure. So Amelia Earhart was a social worker in Boston. One of her main rivals, Ruth Nichols, was the daughter of Wall Street wealth in New York. Louise Sadin, close friends with both Ruth Nichols and Amelia Earhart, was from Bentonville, Arkansas, and had gotten her start selling coal, of all things, in Wichita, Kansas. Ruth Elder was an Alabama housewife, very flashy and already divorced once. And Florence Klingensmith was a young, daring pilot from rural Minnesota just across the Red River from Fargo. These women, as you said, were very different. They came from different backgrounds. Some came from money, some didn't. Some were educated, some weren't. But they did have a few things in common. You know, all of these women had a daring streak to them. They would ride motorcycles. They would jump out of the second-story window of barns just to see what it felt like. They would ride the train around town by hanging off the cow catcher just a few inches off the rails. They all had a daring spirit. They would all be what we would call today early adopters, you know, to get on an airplane in 1927, 1928 was to be bold, much less to fly it. So these women were early adopters. They had a pioneer streak to them. And I think most interesting for people today is their parents. You know, in 1927, 28, a young woman was expected to do one of just a couple of things. You know, society expected her to get married and to have children, or if she were to work, hold one of just a couple of jobs. Certainly these expectations were on these women too. But it's interesting to note that when these characters chose a different path, when they chose to fly, their fathers did not stop it. They did not stand in the way. They did not throw a fit and say no. In some cases, the fathers of these women actually encouraged the flying. And in other cases, they just looked the other way. And I think it's an interesting parenting lesson to see that these fathers in the late 1920s chose to let their daughters find their own path in the world.
Was it ever a challenge for you as a writer to not have Amelia Earhart take over the book?
Certainly Amelia Earhart looms large in our minds today. She is essentially the only female aviator who is celebrated, who is remembered from this time. And I think there was a time early on in the process here, Joe, early on in the writing process, where I had to remind myself, I'm not writing a biography of Amelia Earhart. That is not my purpose. In the time that she was flying, these other women were right there with her. And Some of them were arguably more skilled in a cockpit than she was. And so my goal from the outset was to tell a narrative that weaved together all of their stories, their friendships and their rivalries, their triumphs and their tragedies. It was in some ways more challenging to write that kind of story, but it is the story of that time. You know, Amelia was not alone. These other women were with her.
Did what happened to her have an impact on the other women?
What happened to her in the end, you mean? Her
yes.
disappearance?
Yes.
Absolutely. You know, it was devastating, of course. You know, when Amelia disappeared while trying to fly around the world in 1937, it was a crushing blow for everyone. She was so celebrated, so iconic. She was a legend. And for these women, she was their friend, in some cases, one of their only friends, a woman who could truly understand them as pilots. But it's also worth noting this, you know, Amelia understood the risks of her flight. She knew that if things went wrong over the ocean, it would not end well for her. And her friends knew it too. Louise Staden was probably Amelia's closest friend of these women. And when Amelia went missing and people, reporters, inevitably called Louise to ask her what does she think happened to Amelia, Louise said, you know, clearly she has died. You know, she hit the ocean and she drowned. That was Louise's belief because she and Amelia had talked about it. They knew that if something went wrong over the ocean, it would not end well.
It brings up a point, and you've used the word rivals and even in friendships, and certainly the rivalry makes sense, but by the same token, these are five women who share this love and they share this interest, which had to bring them close together in some way, shape, and form.
Sure. I mean, in the late 1920s, early 1930s, if you were a female aviator, and more than that, you were a woman who dared to race airplanes, there wasn't a lot of other women who could understand that passion, who could understand what you were up against, and specifically could understand the kind of discrimination that you were flying into. And so these women did share that. They did understand how difficult it was to do what each of them was doing. And because of that, they did at times become close. And just as important, Joe, you know, they organized. You know, the women in Fly Girls, you know, would organize and form a group of women pilots, you know, by women pilots, for women pilots, called the 99s. This organization still exists today. And they would use this organization to fight for their rights to be part of the air races.
What do you think ultimately we should take from the story today?
You know, I think this story is for anyone who's ever been told you're not good enough, you don't belong here, you can't do this, and for anyone who's ever stood up to those kind of naysayers who stared down that kind of bully and said, I think you're wrong. You know, these women did that again, again, and again. You know, they were determined to fly in the face of rules that were intended to keep them in their place. But I think it's also worth making another point here. You know, this book isn't just for women. It's not just for girls. I think it's just as important for men to read it, for young boys to read it, and to see that women are just as smart as they are, just as brave as they are, just as fearless as they are.
That was author Keith O'Brien speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. O'Brien's new book is entitled Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. We return to Terra Firma for this next piece, which was originally written as a Facebook post that went viral. It's the story of a strange funeral. The woman who died was a Holocaust survivor who had lived a solitary life for decades. There was concern that no one would even show up for her burial. But as we hear from Ruth Afroni, that's not what happened.
Last week, I went to the funeral of a woman I didn't know. I got a text message that morning. It had words like solitary and childless and also Holocaust survivor and 3 o'clock. So I said, okay. I was going to be in the neighborhood anyway and was curious, and I guess I had nothing better to do. As I walked into the Rehovot Cemetery, I wondered if anyone else would show up. But then I saw a large crowd near the monitor at the entrance, looking for her name among all the other people being buried there that day. Is this the solitary lady's funeral? Someone asked. So I mouthed that word again. Solitary. With what I thought was almost no voice at all. A religious woman, holding a small book of Psalms, put her hand on my shoulder. It's okay, she whispered. None of us knew her either. While the rabbi was speaking, I counted us all. 72 people. 72 strangers who came in the middle of the day, in the middle of shopping or working or picking up the kids or having coffee with an old friend. They were tan brown and pale pink, with yarmulkes or without, men and women, some very old, others teenagers with peach fuzz, who walked over from school after their teacher had read them that same text message. And then the rabbi, beads of sweat glistening on his temples, asked if there was anyone who could say something about the deceased. Anyone? Anything? No one budged. I almost yelled out, me, you know, just to kill the quiet. But then I heard a murmur coming from the back of the group. One pint-sized woman, maybe 4'7" tops, cleared her throat, and the crowd parted to let her pass through. She walked right up to the open grave and stopped. I'll say something, she mumbled, and in a very broken and heavily accented Hebrew, she said, she had degrees. Much degrees, and she worked. 40 years she worked. A woman with pale yellow eyelids, standing right next to me, shook her head and muttered under her breath, a shiksa, that's what she is. Then another woman spoke up, waving her closed umbrella against the blue sky. The departed was from Odessa, she began. They didn't have concentration camps in Odessa. They just kill you in the street. But she managed to run away to Israel. And she'd write letters to those who stayed behind. She'd write, come to Israel. I'd like to add something too. A man in shorts and sandals chimed in. The yellow-eyed lady said, oh, finally! As if she'd been waiting for this the whole time. So I asked her who the man was, and she replied, what do you mean? That's Nachmani, that's who. I just nodded silently. Nachmani knelt to the ground and took a lump of dirt from the grave in his fist. He said, softly, that this land was once his grandfather's orange grove. All of this was orange groves, he declared, and then said it was an honor for him that the deceased was now buried in this earth. Amen, he looked up with dry eyes. May this land be good to us. May this soil be good to us. Just before people began to scatter, a tall, fidgety woman, a municipal social worker, told the group that the departed refused to accept any help. I'm good on my own, she used to say. Somebody to make you a cup of tea, the tall woman would ask. To bring you a blanket, to help you get out of bed? No, she didn't want any of that. It was a social worker who came up with the idea of sending out the text message. This is an emergency, she had pleaded with the folks at the Rehovot City hotline. This woman has no one. No one but a bunch of strangers who may or may not get this text. The thought of not having a minion at the funeral shattered her. And here you all are, she said, and her voice cracked just a bit. I can't believe you came. The yellow eyelids next to me were full of tears, and so were the tan brown ones and the pale pink ones. And those of the old and the young, the women and the men, the Jews and the Shiksas. So for one brief moment, in the middle of the mess that is our lives, we huddled together, and we were close. It is us, the living, more than the dead, who need this grace. And I knew that we were all thinking the same thing, that it was too little and too late, that had we come sooner, one at a time, with a bowl of soup, or a smile, or just a kind word, then maybe she would have been less alone, and maybe we would have had something to say about her at her funeral. So rest in peace, Maya Chernichovsky, the daughter of Ben Zion, for you had a lovely name, many academic degrees, and 40 years of work. You wrote letters to your friends in Odessa and kindled your solitude like a caveman would kindle his fire. And you gave me a moment of tenderness, a moment of belonging. May your soul be bound in the bond of the odd life in this hard and beloved land.
Ruth Afroni is a TV producer and writer. Her first book, a collection of autobiographical essays, was published this year. Is high testosterone hurting women's hearts? Elizabeth Tracy reports.
Women typically manifest heart disease after menopause, and for years, estrogen was thought to be important. Now new research by Aaron Mikos, a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins, and colleagues shows that the dominant male hormone, testosterone, is also a factor.
And we had individuals representing four race ethnicities. These women were all after menopause and no history of heart attacks or strokes. And we measured hormone levels and then followed them to see who went on and developed a heart attack or a stroke. We found that women with higher levels of testosterone, the male type hormone, relative to estrogen levels, had increased risk of stroke, of heart failure, compared to women with lower levels. After we took into account other risk factors for heart disease, such as blood pressure, cholesterol, smoking,
Mikos notes that in women, testosterone is known to be important in libido as well as muscle health, and says it's the relative levels of estrogen and testosterone that may be the issue. At Johns Hopkins, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
Cornell University's College of Engineering says it now enrolls equal numbers of undergraduate women and men. The college says it reached the milestone with the arrival of the class of 2022 amid increased outreach. Cornell Engineering now has 1,556 female undergraduates and 1,567 male undergraduates. Women actually outnumber men in the incoming class, 412 to 366. Nationwide, women represent less than a quarter of undergraduate engineering majors. A Massachusetts Living History Museum that depicts life in the early 19th century is looking to overhaul the way it presents the past in an effort to stay relevant to a 21st century audience, and that means looking at women's roles. Old Sturbridge Village has received a $75,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It will use to partner with scholars and other consultants for a multi-year study into how it portrays four areas: agriculture and food, civics, industry and economy, and race and gender. As part of this, the museum will take a look at the role women played in early 19th century society. The museum in Sturbridge depicts life in a small New England town of the 1830s. And a new study says that the TV industry's hiring of first-time female directors and directors of color hit record highs for the second year in a row. According to a Directors Guild of America study, women represented 41% of first-time TV episode directors in the 2017-2018 season. The Guild says that's 8 percentage points higher than the previous season. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1521.